To everyone who has tuned in and is listening or watching on our podcast or video cast, today's interview is going to be with British rock climber Steve McClure. And I'm not going to let Steve do his own intro into this interview, because Steve is one of those people who isn't, well, I'm going to call you a legend. I'm afraid you're going to probably shake your head with me now, but he is a real legend of British climbing. And he's also very hard to get him to blow his own trumpet. So I'm going to do it right at the start here now, so you all get the context of how accomplished Steve is. So Steve is, he's made the first ascent of the hardest limestone sport route in the UK, Rain Man. This was a long project, which he finally did in 2017. He has a career which spans many years operating right at the top of the grade. Even his first entry into the 9A sport grade with mutation is almost certainly not 9A, and is at least 9A plus, knowing some other climbers have tried this for a very long time. So he was really ahead of his time, even when he got into the highest grades of sport climbing. He's also climbed pretty much most of the hardest, really cutting edge trad routes in the UK as well. He probably won't even call himself a trad climber, but he still kind of puts it down on that stuff. Still an adventure climber as well. He's competed in the international competition circuits and has really just done a lot over many, many years. And he's finally turned 50 years old last year, coming up to 51 now. And I am really looking forward to just exploring with Steve essentially an already fairly lengthy career in climbing right at the top and the things that you've experienced and what you see making the difference. So welcome to the interview, and sorry that I had to kind of put you on the spot there, rip straight off.
It's all right. I must admit, all the stuff you mentioned there, it seems like such a long time ago now that I've forgotten most of it. But yeah, it has been a while. It's definitely been a while, but yeah, and hopefully the same to come again.
Yeah. Well, how many years have you been climbing now then?
Tricky question, because obviously when did I start would be the question. I mean, I can recall times going at my folks when I was 10 or 11. And I've got pictures of me climbing with my folks when I'm like 2 or even 1 years old. So yeah, I started before I could even walk. But I think there was a pivotal moment when I started seriously when I was about 24 or 25. That was when I started trying hard things. That's when performance became part of the deal. So before that, I'd done a lot of climbing, a lot of traditional climbing in my teens, like 15, 16, things like, like left wall, right wall, E5s, few E6s, that kind of thing. But it wasn't performance driven. It was absolutely just about the whole package. But then something clicked. I think when I sort of got into sport climbing, suddenly it was like, right, performance. And then my grade shot through the roof. So that was when I started on the performance tunnel, as I sometimes phrase it. So I've been in that kind of zone now for about 25 years. So yeah, half my life of hanging on small edges.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that you gain from doing or see from doing anything for 25 years at your, you know, whether it's your own personal limit or the limits of what's going on in the sport. And I think that's, yeah, it's super interesting because, you know, as you are probably aware of the kind of coaching work that I do, I've worked with quite a lot of people that might have only been at their limit for 3 years, 5 years at the top of the game. Yeah. And they feel already quite experienced with it and they think they know a lot. And I always kind of come back from that context of, well, you really don't know that much yet. I mean, come and talk to me and Steve, and when we've been going for a long, long time, and you'll look back at those first 3 to 5 years and realize there was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it's, I think you start to realize where you've been and where you could go. That starts to become very relevant once you've been in the game for, it's got to be 10 years at least. You know, when I look back 15 years, I was barely even starting compared to what I achieved. Things like red point projects, particularly, you know, you think you're done You know, I can remember on numerous occasions saying, I'll never climb any harder than that. And I look back now and I wasn't even trying. It's just nowhere near.
Yeah. So you had this period where you were climbing, you know, what for most people were quite hard trad grades, you know, around that E5 level. And a lot of people find that, you know, even those grades quite aspirational. And then you converted across into more sport climbing. When you moved over into sport climbing, did you end up at kind of grades that were similar around that, you know, 7A to 7B, 7B plus region, or did you actually quickly jump forward on your relative sport grades and sort of go through that 8A barrier quite quickly from there?
So, yeah, good question. So I was on sighting around the E5, E6 mark on places like Pembroke, because that's a good comparison to sort of sport climbing. Gritstone, I was doing similar grade, but there's not many which fit the bill because they're quite bold, a lot of them. So I went a lot of peak sport routes. And yes, I was on a similar kind of level around maybe the 7B, 7B plus kind of grade, going for the on-site and getting quite a lot of on-sites of that kind of grade. And that immediately translates to about 8A on a red point.
Yeah.
So I think the real difference for me was I was a complete on-site traditional climber. And I because I'm not very bold, I was probably going things within my grade relatively. I didn't fall off very much at all. So I was probably capable of on-siting around the 7B plus-ish sport grade. But I had no concept of red pointing at all. I just didn't know anything about it. But the numbers were there. You know, 8A was there, 8B was there. And they were so inspiring. I'd read about it in, you know, The Power of Climbing, that amazing book. I'd read about it in there. And it was just like, wow, God, if I could climb that kind of route, it'd be just so cool. And then suddenly I was. And it was like, oh, my God, this is just unbelievable. So that really propelled me massively. So I think when I was climbing the E5s and E6s, I was already at the 8A, 8A plus kind of grade, but I just didn't know it. So to suddenly realize that I was there was just amazing. It was brilliant.
And do you have any kind of concept of, I know bouldering was a lot less of a, you know, its own thing back then, but do you have a concept of where you were roughly with your kind of bouldering grades at that kind of time as well?
I would struggle to be sure, but things like so in terms of actual brute bouldering, I've never been very good at that. But for say things like, you know, like Jerry's Traverse at Stanage,
yeah,
on 7C plus, so that was something that I could do relatively quickly straight away. But in terms of one move blocks, don't know.
Yeah, I mean, one move is hard to say, aren't they?
Yeah, very.
Yeah, okay. And so when you went through, when you made that transition from that kind of, you know, 8A, 8A plus, 8B, and then you, the sport climbing scene itself or the standards really transitioned through your career as well. What do you feel was the kind of the change in your approach or the way you either ran your, you know, how much climbing you were doing or any supplementary training you were doing or your lifestyle that really moved you on from that? Well, I think nowadays it's seen as a very accessible grade, 8A to 8B, for example, whereas a lot of people still even now will put 8C, 8C plus, 9A into a really kind of elite category. What changed for you over that time?
So I think the main things that changed was volume of climbing in that specific style. So before I jumped into the sort of sport climbing world, my climbing life was very much a sort of trip based and sort of whenever I can be really bothered to go out to the peak to do some easy bouldering or maybe a few trad routes, but it just wasn't focused at all. And the group of people I was hanging out with, they were all E1, E2 climbers. So we'd go out and we'd spend an evening climbing. And anything hard was driven, it was driven by me. So we'd be doing E1s, we'd be doing E2s. And I'd say, oh, you know, I might try doing this E5. But it wasn't like they were saying, oh, Steve, do you want to try this E5? I'd have to sort of will myself to do it. And they'd be almost like, oh, really? Okay, well, so I'd maybe do one E5. They'd be like, okay, that was great. And then that'd be it for a few weeks, potentially. So there's very, very little for the hard stuff, hardly any hard climbing. And there was no training. We'd maybe go to the foundry, but it was all like once a week. We were students and, you know, we were party heads. I wasn't driven by climbing, but as soon as I found this sort of sport climbing thing, suddenly it was three times a week at Ravenstor, down the Cornice, always trying really hard, always like aching, fingers aching, and then resting, and then more and more and more. So I was just doing so much volume that my grade just went up. I mean, I can remember doing my first grade 8, which was actually Zeke the Freak, which is 8B. I did that 1 year. And then I think I did an 8B plus 2 years later, and then a 9A 2 years after that. Mm. So it was a pretty quick jumping up, to be honest. There was no hanging around, but it was volume. Yeah. It was mainly volume. In terms of people are going to say, you know, what training were you doing? No training. Like there was no training at all. It was just occasionally going to the foundry, but there was no actual training. It was just a few routes here and there, but it was all about outside. Although I can talk about one element of training, if you like. So the one thing, so if we just talk about training very, very quickly, for me, I think that if you want to get good at climbing and you want to train for climbing, you need to train for your goals specifically. So you need to work out what your goals require. And I think that's really important, because I see a lot of people training these days. And I just think, what are you doing that for? That's not going to get you up what you want to do. But we can talk about that later. But anyway, I looked at what I was doing, what I needed, and I think I invented foot-on campusing. Because it, to me, that looked like the most perfect way to train for the sort of stuff I wanted to do, which was overhanging by maybe 20 degrees, relatively small handles, and on the wall for maybe 2 or 3 minutes, getting absolutely blown forearms. So I couldn't campus because I wasn't strong enough. So I put my feet on, went up and down for a few minutes, got really, really pumped, did that for, I don't know, a couple of years probably, once a week. And I reckon it's done the test of time. I reckon I think it's personally the best way of power endurance training that you can have.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really nice blend of essentially kind of moderate intensity or moderate to high intensity, no, moderate slash high intensity fingerboarding and systematized climbing movement in a way on a wall, because it's like a blend. It's not pure proper climbing movement, you know, all over the place and lots of complexity, but your body's at least in that chain of engagement or movement, like on a wall, but you're stressing the fingers in a really standardized way. It doesn't change, you know, you're not breaking different sizes of holds.
Yeah, I completely rate that as an exercise, because as soon as you start trying to do that kind of intensity on a boulder problem, you don't isolate the forearms. I think you need to do both things. But when you want to just work on your forearms and fingers, that exercise, it just hits the spot completely. So I was doing some of that at the same time, and I just found that I could just hang on for ages. You know, routes like things like Mecca is a really good example. It's, you know, it might take you like 2 minutes to climb it, and you're on your fingers the whole time. And I mean, the moves aren't super hard, but you just need to be able to hang on. So yeah, that exercise, I think, was pivotal. But mainly, in answer to your question, it was volume of that type of climbing.
Yeah. And it, of course, has a, you know, a high degree of specificity that, like, I always say this to people, that whenever if you're going to look at one thing that you can do in climbing to improve your climbing, is take something which looks very, very similar to the thing that you want to achieve. And if you do that, it's going to have a really high transfer. So for example, if you really want to get good at climbing at Ravenstor on this length of route, if you're going to really dial it down, go to Ravenstor and climb on that length of route a lot. A lot of people can't because they don't have, you know, 4 days a week that they can go to the Crag, or they live in London, or wherever it might be. But that is the real reality of training for sport. Specificity, every time it wins out.
I'm afraid that is probably one of the most important bits of advice that you could give to anybody. And I think with our sport as well, because it's such a complicated sport, it is probably even more important. And the problem with that, of course, is if you don't have access, but your goals are to climb on rock, then you're going to have to get super, super strong, overly strong, to compensate for the lack of volume on the rock, which is a bit of a shame. And I feel very lucky that I had the access to what I wanted to do, to be honest. My targets and my goals were right there, right in front of me, so I could just go and hammer away at them.
Yeah. And having, climbed for a number of decades now, and also been at that 9A standard for a long time as well, so you're essentially putting your body under fairly high intensity stress, you know, multiple times, multiple years, I'm going to, you know, assume here that during that career, you reached a point where you felt like actually the improvements were just getting, you know, really small, really incremental. And you kind of felt like you were maybe reaching your own genetic ceiling or lifestyle ceiling or approach ceiling, whatever you want to call it. When did that come for you in your career? What did it feel like? How did you sort of deal with that?
That's an interesting one. So I think you tend to mentally shift your targets and your goals, and whether you do that because you can't make gains in a certain area, whether you you actively do that, or whether it just happens, you know, maybe you're kind of kidding yourself in a way. So, you know, people they tend to move through sports, move to different sports or different areas of sports. I think I found myself more inspired by traditional climbing, more inspired by adventure climbing. That's what motivates me now. Is that because I can't climb as hard, or is it because I really want to do that other stuff? I don't really know. However, I don't feel as though I'm actually stopped by my performance on the sport yet. I almost certainly will have reached my physical sort of limits, but I think you can keep on getting better technically for a long time. And I've noticed almost like step changes over the years where I've thought, oh, I'm actually climbing better than I was last year or the year before. And that has happened certainly into my late 40s. The last couple of years, I can't really say. So last year was a bit of a write-off, as you know. The year before, I got some good traditional routes. In fact, I felt as though I was climbing as good as I ever had done in my whole life. Mm. The year before, I climbed Rain Man, which was as hard as I've ever climbed. So I don't feel as I've reached that point yet, but I psychologically and mentally feel like I'm moving into different areas. And whether that's because I've maxed out in one area or just because I'm losing interest, I don't know. It's a really interesting topic. And certainly we could talk about the physical side of what happens once you get to 50s. I can go into that if you want.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think this is an area which lots of people are really interested in, because I think, you know, most people are aware that the difference or the changes that you see in your body when you're 25 years old versus when you're 45 years old versus when you're 65 years old are very different. You can't take the same approaches and expect the same results. And two, even if you did take slightly more intelligent approaches, you won't often see the same results that you got when you were 25.
No, there's obviously a huge difference. The rate at which people warm up just blows me away. For example, so I can go hang out with my 9-year-old lad now, and from literally lying down asleep, he can jump up and bang out 10 pull-ups. I can barely hang on the bar. You know, I can barely hang on the bar. It like hurts my shoulders, it hurts my elbows. And after half an hour warm up, I'm good to go. You know, I can do 20 pull-ups, no problem. But that warm up, it takes a long time. It could take me an hour to get warmed up, and you've got to factor that in. So it's going to take time before you've even started your training. That's a big thing. Volume in terms of how much you can fit in as well. You know, if I do a hard session, I'm knacked for, I probably need 2 rest days. So in terms of your improvement curve, you just can't do as much. You know, I can do 2 hard sessions a week. If you're young, you might be able to do 5. So you're just going to be able to get more in and get better. Also, your ability to actually gain strength. I mean, you might know a lot more about this than I do, but I have definitely noticed that the bigger muscles, I struggle now to make gains. It's interesting we should be talking about this now, because I just thought about this just yesterday, how about 7 years ago, I got a knee injury, and I thought, okay, so I can't climb or walk, so I'm just going to train pull-up strength. And I went from being able to do no pull-ups to being able to do 3 one-arm pull-ups. When I said, sorry, not no pull, no one-arm pull-ups. To do to doing 3 one-arm pull-ups, and that's like proper ones where you go to a total straight arm and then you hang there for a bit and then lock it out. I could do 3 of those in a row, which was felt like a really big gain for me. I was pleased with that. Anyway, over the years that sort of dropped back down again because I wasn't training it, but I've always been able to do one-arm pull-up, and then I could only do 1 one-arm pull-up from a little bit of a bent arm. Anyway, during lockdown, I've trained it back up again, or tried to, and it's just been such hard work. And now I can just about do one from a straight arm, but only on a good day. And that is with more training than before. So it's just taken forever. But on the flip side, my actual finger strength has gone up quite a lot during the last year. And it's when I say a lot, okay, it's not like 20% or anything, but you know, I can quite comfortably hang on the lattice rung now, either arm, for 10 seconds. Whereas before,
Easy.
well, before I couldn't hang it at all, couldn't do it. There's no way I could do it. So I can probably hang the Beastmaker rung with a plus 10 kilos, whereas before I would have managed maybe +3, +4. So noticeable gains in the actual finger strength, which you would have thought would be very hard to get from somebody who'd spent 25 years hanging on small edges. So in a nutshell, I'm waffling here. In a nutshell, I'm finding the bigger muscles are harder to make gains on, but the fingers are still making gains. So we'll be interested. I'm really interested to see how this translates to the rock, because I've not actually had a chance to really see what happens there yet.
I tell you, but perhaps some of my thoughts on this is because it's a really interesting scenario that you've got here, and I think my thoughts on this, or the, at least the road that it's leading me down, is that essentially when you look at strength in, you know, a muscle or in, you know, an athlete, human, whatever you want to look at it as, is that you have a sort of a number of different approaches that you can take with it. You have the kind of the technique element, the technique to apply strength. It is a technique, a skill. You have that, you know, muscle size, that cross-sectional area. You have the recruitment elements. And then also you have tendon stiffness and lateral transfer within the muscle itself in terms of tendon sheath, collagen fibers. And you've got essentially, and then also you have the muscular, sort of intermuscle muscular coordination that you occur in muscles, particularly in muscle groups. So where you have an agonist and an antagonist. So in a basic sense, in a forearm, you have a flexor and extensor. In the shoulder, you have all sorts of different muscles there. And, you know, down to your hip, you have, you know, glutes, hamstrings, hip flexors. And what you may see in this scenario that I'm thinking of is that over the past year is that you have lost a lot of your climbing volume, not being able to go outside, not being able to go to the gym all of the time. So essentially, you may have lost some of that intermuscular coordination that you get in the larger muscle groups just from those big movements, full body movements. So you'll see what looks like a relative loss in strength, because it's, you just haven't got enough of that movement, especially at a higher intensity. But in contrast, when you look at the forearm and what you're doing with the fingerboarding, we nearly all have access to a fingerboard at home, even on like a year of lockdown. So you may be able to still hit those four areas of strength improvement, including that intermuscular coordination. So you still get your four, you know, pillars of strength going forward, whereas the other one, you lost one of the big pillars, which for you at the elite end will be noticeable because you're a pretty well fine-tuned person. So that'd be my thought on that anyway.
So that, I think you, I'm thinking this through now, and I hadn't thought about it like that, but that actually makes a massive amount of sense, because I've been doing a sort of battery of exercises, things like bicep curls, low rows, press ups, lots of different sort of pull-up type things, assisted one-armers, shoulder shrugs, front levers, going through like a set of exercises, which just keep me sane, really. It would take sort of two and a half hours, and it would leave me feeling like, oh, wow, I'm pretty tired. But I noticed on a few of the bouldering sessions that I had, I've only had like a couple of sessions outdoors, and I just felt wasted afterwards. Just completely wasted. Didn't feel wasted in the sort of muscle groups that I've been training, but all that kind of wide squeezing and lock-offs and Gastons and all this sort of stuff, it was just like, oh my God, I'm flipping knackered. Why aren't I really strong after all this training? I think, like you say, it's a different kind of thing. And the forearm, when you're working at it on a fingerboard, yeah, you're going to see some gains because it's very specific to that board. And that might translate to the rock as well, because it's just pulling on an edge. But I think the whole body stuff, that might be lacking. So hopefully I'll be able to get that plugged back in once we can actually go indoors and outdoors with a better weather as well.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing, is that that is an element of strength that comes back. And it can also, it's also very workable as you get older. It's the same thing that I always explain to especially like aging athletes, is that they become, I think, really unskilled in high intensity work, because in their heads they often see it as a risky thing to do. Yeah. And so they can be doing all this really like basic strength work, but then you go, but are you really accessing and learning how to operate in your one rep max, your two rep max, your three rep max, the bit that feels risky? Whereas they'll go, oh yeah, happy to do eight reps on something which feels quite hard.
Yeah.
But they don't like one and two rep maxes. But there is a significant technique part to that. So I
would completely agree with that. The risk, it feels risky. And you, at your relatively young age, you won't quite know yet how risky it feels. It feels like you're just going to break sometimes, and you mentally just shy away from it. I find it quite hard to access that these days. So like you say, I can access this sort of eight rep max, which is equivalent to maybe a sort of like 2 minute long route with not particularly hard moves. So yeah, I can go all out on that. But trying like a one move, absolute ball breaker of a boulder problem, I just feel like I'm going to rip my joints out. So your brain just doesn't want to go there. And whether you would break yourself or whether you wouldn't is maybe up for debate. But because you feel like you're going to break, there's this protective thing that just says, oh, if I break myself here, I'm out for 3 months. So I'll just not try this boulder problem, or I'll just not try that hard. But I know that once you start dropping the intensity, then, you know, it's a slope out of there, isn't it? You need to keep it up, but it's hard to.
Yeah, for sure. That's really, really interesting. And how's it been with, I'm trying to think now how many years you've been in roughly in climbing. Let's call it a good 25, 30 years. You're saying earlier it was 25 years. That higher end, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I can remember I traveled like I traveled a lot when I was like 24. I didn't really climb at all. And then as soon as I got back from this traveling trip when I was 24, 25, then it was just boom straight in. And I've not done really anything else since. So 25 years of trying very hard.
And in that 25 years, what's the injury journey been like? And how have you, I mean, in 25 years, you're going to have had a reasonable share of injuries across that. What's the big ones that have occurred? Have you learned anything over that 25 years of injuries?
Okay, so in terms of injuries, I've had bad feet, two bad knees, one got operated on, hips survived so far, both shoulders have been through the mill, both elbows, both wrists, all fingers, neck. Yeah, so most stuff has had a beating. There's been only, I think, twice, there's been twice where I thought that I'd had a career ending injury, and I really believed that for both of them. One was a finger, and it was bad for 2-3 years. I saw a lot of different physios. I had 3 cortisone injections in the finger. I went to see Volker out in Germany, and I can't remember which finger it was now. But I thought that was game over. And then a shoulder, which made a horrible tearing noise. This is about 6 years ago. That had a lot of physio, got MRI scanned, ultrasound scanned. They couldn't see anything torn, but it was obviously something going on. Since then, my other shoulder got really sore as well. That's a bit sore still at the moment. So going back to just as an example of how bad my left shoulder was, I hurt it trying Keen Roof at Ravenstor, a sort of twisty, undercutty thing. I just became aware it was really flipping sore, and then suddenly it was really sore, so much that I was training at the Foundry. I realized I couldn't do a single pull-up, couldn't do one pull-up or one press-up, and I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? So I had to stop. And when I started to like rehab it, I couldn't do a bicep curl with anything more than 1 kilogram. So it was bad. It's back up to a reasonable level now. I can do a bicep curl with maybe 10 kilos, but the other one can do it with like 18 kilos. So I've got a long way to go still. What have I learned? Obviously the first thing you learn is warm up. The second thing you learn is don't push through, because there's a lot of times you push through an injury. You must have had this where you go, oh, I've just tweaked my shoulder, but it'll be all right. I'll just carry on. So sometimes you can push through, but the sort of one bit of advice I'd give is if you feel like you've got an injury, just stop for half an hour. And in half an hour, you'll know. You'll either know whether you can carry on, or you'll know whether you'll be like flipping, like, I'm glad I stopped because this is actually quite bad. That's a crucial thing. In fact, that's the one thing I'd say for anybody like relatively ancient like me, really take that on board. If you feel that you've got a tweak, just rest for half an hour and then reassess after that. And maybe you can just carry on, but there's been a few times where I've thought, oh, got a bit of a sore elbow, I'll be all right, I'll just carry on for a bit. And you think, no, I won't do, actually. And half an hour later, you're like, whoa, I'm pretty glad I didn't climb then. And then maybe in a week's time or even 3 or 4 days, it's all right again. But you know that if you'd pushed on, it would have been a disaster.
Yeah, that's really good advice, that. I like that, because it basically gets you to make a sort of an intentional break in your climbing, and doesn't let you to do that thing where you kind of mask the tweak by getting really warmed up and adrenaline's rushing round and you're excited and everything like that.
Yeah, because when you're warmed up, you can sort of hide injuries. So let yourself just cool down a little bit and then reassess. And I think I've saved the day quite a few times. Or when I say save the day, save the future by reassessing. But I mean, I suppose another useful thing, it doesn't apply to everybody and it doesn't apply to every injury, and maybe I've been lucky so far, is every injury I've had, it has all come good in the end. Now that that maybe I've just been lucky there, because sometimes obviously it doesn't work out like that. But I try to, if I get an injury, not to let it get me down, to think, okay, well, historically, they have sorted themselves out. Some have taken quite a while, but some have actually taken, you know, maybe a couple of months and it's gone away. So don't get too down. In fact, even see it as an opportunity. You know, maybe you've got a bad whatever. Maybe you've got a bad finger. Okay, so I'm just going to work on my upper body strength and let my fingers recover. Or maybe the other way around. Maybe you've got you've hurt your elbow, so you're just going to work on your finger strength. You know, you can use these as an opportunity. Don't let it get you down. I mean, chances are it will come good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've told this to so many people now, and I think people don't even believe me. Like, it can't really be like that, but pretty much every significant injury I've had that's been like at least a 3 to 9 month job has been the best thing that happened to my climbing career every single time. And the best thing now is that because I know it, sometimes when they happen, I'm in such a positive mindset when they happen. Like, I hate this now. I really do. I'm not happy, but I know this is going to pan out to be one of the best things for my climbing. And you just get it in your head. When you repeat it enough times, you go through that cycle, it comes and it's no longer a disaster. It's, I hate it, but I know this is a proper opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. I think seeing it as opportunity is the way forward. But still, the target is don't get injured. That's like rule number one is don't get injured, because it... I think one of the problems with getting injured is you might be able to push through it in the end, but they do kind of haunt you to a certain extent. You kind of live with them. And like at the moment, like I know, like both my shoulders are not great. And when I'm, if I'm doing a max hang, so when I'm doing a max hang on my right arm, I can only get my best result by doing a complete dangle. So not engaging my shoulder. My shoulder is, it doesn't engage very well. It's not strong enough to. On my left arm, if I do a dangle, it hurts my shoulder, so I have to engage. So I've got two different injuries that make me do different things. If I had no injuries, it'd be fine. But they're there now, and I can still climb with them. I've had them for quite a long time. They haven't stopped me yet. So, yeah, try to avoid it. But if you do, then use it as an opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And when you have injuries now, do you feel like you tend to just go into your own process of rehab and you kind of read around and talk to friends and other climbers? Or are you a kind of diehard, right, I just go and see a physio straight away and just get it looked at? Or what kind of approach would you tend to take with that?
Well, for a start, I'm obviously a tight ass, so I don't go straight to the physio. There's some really good, very, very good physios out there, of course. I've got so much experience of injuries that I often feel like I know more than the physio now. Mm. So most cases I'll know what's going on. Things like shoulders. Shoulders are the weird one, because there's all kinds of things in there. And you, ultimately, with a shoulder, you want to know whether you've torn something that needs to be surgically repaired, because ultimately... things pull away and can't grow back. That's the kind of my understanding of shoulder things, if they tear. But everything else, pretty much everything else, will just fix by itself. You know, like fingers, it doesn't matter what you've done, pretty much the rehab is the same. So just get on with usual finger rehab. Just gently stress it. Don't crimp if you've knackered an eight, one of your pulleys, just open hand, it'll come good. Things like elbows, I think there's so much stuff online now about how to deal with an elbow tendonitis. They're not too bad, but yeah, the shoulders are the weird one. So I've seen physios for my shoulders, had various scans, but touch wood, so far they've not seen anything that needs to be attacked with a knife, so fingers crossed.
I'm just about starting to get over mine now, and I had the first month was just awful. Like it killed changing gear in the car. I couldn't touch a pull up.
Can't sleep at night.
Like I couldn't even get my arm above my shoulder level just to lift it with nothing in it.
Yeah.
And just what was it?
What was it?
Sorry?
What was it? Do you know?
It was just a really severe aggravation of the tendon attachment in the shoulder. I thought it was like a tear because it got so sort of inflamed and tight and protective that it was clunking all over the place. It was making horrendous noise. I could like hear it, but I think I just got so scared about the whole thing that I was probably holding it in a weird way. And I just went and got a scan from like an ultrasound from a physio in Sheffield. And as soon as he like looked inside of it and he was like, right, you haven't got a slap tear, you haven't got a tear here, I think I just immediately relaxed within a day and I just got on with rehab. And then, you know, a month and a half later, it's actually kind of like 6 out of 10 fixed.
Okay, so shoulder-wise, I mean, that's quite a useful bit of advice there, which people would probably be pleased to hear. A lot of shoulder injuries are caused by inflammation of the tendon because it's so complicated in the shoulder. So you get some inflammation, which then it gets aggravated, and being climbers, we don't stop, we carry on. So you get stuck in a cycle of it getting more and more and more aggravated without actually having a chance to recover. And as soon as you stop and it recovers a bit, you go, oh, feeling a bit better, I'm going to go down the wall and do a little bit more. And it goes back up again and gets even worse. So the guy I saw just said, look, you've not torn anything, but you're going to have to just let this recover down to a level which it can handle. So I just backed off completely. And it took a while. Took maybe 3 weeks, and then I was aware that I could do a bit, but I just learned to not push it too far. So I was like, rather than spiraling up, I sort of spiraled down, if you get what I mean. Took the inflammation away. I kept on just tweaking it, just tweaked it a little bit, just back off a bit, let it go a bit. And it gradually, I found that the inflammation went away. But he just said, you're stuck in a spiral. And it's because you're too flipping stubborn to stop. Like, you let it, you know, it's 10 out of 10 bad. You let it get to 9 out of 10 bad. And you immediately break it again. So let it get to maybe 5 and see where you're at from there. Sounds like yours is the same as mine.
Yeah. I mean, I try and tell people that essentially when you're rehabbing something, don't expect during that rehab to be going in and doing exercises or doing climbing and it to be down at 0 out of 10 or 1 out of 10 in terms of pain. Like, expect 3 out of 10 to be very common, quite often 4s, sometimes even 5s with the right approach with it. It's going to be uncomfortable during that rehab process.
Yeah.
And most, as long as you track the direction of the overall pain on rest days and, you know, sort of rehab or training days, whatever you want to call it, as long as it's going in a certain direction, it's really good feedback that you're doing the right thing. Because like all the way through the last month, I've had so many sessions where I've gone, oh, this is just a disaster still. It's like really painful and everything like that. But I get up the next day and I go, yeah, actually, it's kind of like 0.1% better. It definitely is. And I can see it improving over time. So I don't get overly scared or, you know, put off by relatively poor or uncomfortable sessions because I can see the direction is going one way.
Yeah, I think maybe the key to it is to actually be honest with yourself. So like, for instance, with this left shoulder recently, that I was aware that it was definitely, it had been injured in some capacity, but I didn't want it to be injured. I just carried on and it was getting more and more sore, but for some reason I thought it maybe would just go away by itself. But I should have learned from past experience. It was only when, like I say, I literally couldn't do a single pull-up. It was like, mate, you know, you should be able to do one pull-up. If you can't do one pull-up, definitely time to stop. So as soon as I, like, it's sort of like step change that. It's like, right, you know, rehab starts now. And as soon as I decided that, it was fine. It was when I was kidding myself. So I decided it, and then I just did different things. I let it rest for a bit, and then I just backed off what was hurting it, did other stuff, and yeah, it was okay. But you need to be honest with yourself. You know, if it's bad, then know it's bad and take the appropriate action. And there's a lot of things you can still do. Mm. You just have to be aware of what you can't do.
Yeah. On that same kind of train of kind of discussion around I suppose doing things that you can't if you've got an injury, you know, you can, there's always other stuff that you can do, train the other parts of the body and that. I'm really interested to know your thoughts on the kind of trainable nature of the psychological element of climbing, whether that's, you know, confidence in your own abilities, the ability to be able to kind of grind through uncomfortable situations, be good with falling, heights, etc., and how adaptable you think that is and how much you can change it. Because I've known you for a pretty long amount of time now, and you've always come across to me as being a climber who's good with falling and heights and a good confident climber in terms of routability. You're quite kind of objective, like black and white about it. And I've always really, I suppose in a way, I've been quite jealous of that, that you can look at things and go, well, it's that far on the fall. I know that gear's good. So I'll just take it. That's fine. And I go, that sounds amazing that Steve can do that, because I have quite an emotional response where I do it. And I go, beforehand, I'll be analytical, but I get up there and go, freaking hell, that's like a whole 3 meters above the gear. That seems really scary. I don't want to do this now. Take me home.
I mean, maybe there's a bit of an engineer's approach in there.
Okay. Yeah.
I think I'm not a bold climber. Are we talking about the sort of like bold things here?
I suppose if we can split it into two halves, maybe. One about the sort of boldness and falling and everything of that with climbing, because I think that's a really common thing that a lot of people struggle with. And then perhaps we can go into the mindset around, you know, perseverance and sticking at it and going through things.
Okay, so first of all, I suppose in a relatively condensed version, I think I'm quite good at really being able to pin down what is rational and what is irrational. So for instance, if there's a bolt at 2/3 of the way up the route and the route is overhanging, then I know that I'm good to go to the top of the crag, because I'm not going to hit the floor and I'm not going to swing into anything or hit any ledges. If I know that, then I can keep that in my head and I can just go. And I think I'm very good at keeping that thought, which is something that maybe other people can't keep as well. I mean, the classic one is that you're climbing up a traditional route, you put in like an absolute bomber piece of kit. Oh, that's brilliant. And you do one move up and you're like, oh my God. Oh my God, I don't want to fall off now. I'm going to really hurt myself. It's like, you've got like a bomber by your feet. You remember. And they're like, oh yeah, I have got. But they just can't remember. Whereas and this is something I try and teach people when I'm coaching them, is when you put your protection in, assess it. I do this thing where I rate my protection. So if it's like if it's as good as a bolt, I give it a 5 out of 5. If it's like pretty bad, I give it like a 1 out of 5 or whatever. And I just sort of say it to myself. So I'll put it in and go, whoa, that's a 5 out of 5, that mate. And the act of saying it reinforces that it's super good. Mm. And I'll know where I am in the route. I'll know how far I can go above there. So like, for example, if it's 2/3 of the way up and I get this 5 out of 5 piece, it's like, I'm done. Like, I'm going all the way now. Like, I don't need any more gear. If I get some more, then great. But I don't need more. I can go all the way. So being able to compartmentalize that, I think, is one of my, I'd say, one of my skills.
Yeah.
The flip side is that if I don't get something that I'm happy with, I'm not confident at all. And, you know, my ability to climb towards my physical limit in a bold situation is very poor, like relative to other climbers who seem to be incredibly bold. I mean, look at my Gritstone list is pathetic. It's doesn't exist. And all of the hard traditional routes I've done, if you were to look at them individually, you'll see that they can be broken down into being relatively safe. I'm attacking them like a sport route, really. You know, things like you know, even like Rhapsody, the Dave McLeod E11, before I even set off that, I was like, it's safe. I can fall off the top of the crag and I'll be totally fine. So I never really put myself in any real danger. And the dangerous things were very completely calculated. I went through the whole process. I knew that the risks were low, because if the risks were high, then I wouldn't go there.
And have you found that you've always been like that through your climbing career, that, you know, even in your 20s and when you made that transition from you went from, you know, trad climbing across into sport climbing and then applied that again back into some trad climbing, was it just always there, or do you think you've actually got better at that objectivity over time?
So I probably got better, but it was definitely always there, because if I look way back on the routes that I was doing when I was like 12, 13, they weren't really bold routes. There was very few. So things like, I haven't done things like Green Death, Edge Lane, you know, I haven't done those routes because they were just too risky as far as I was concerned. They're not very hard. I almost certainly wouldn't fall off them, but too risky. So the E9s and E10s and things I've done felt as though they weren't high risk. And I think that's something I've always done. Some of the trad routes I've done more recently were a bit closer to, you know, pushing into unknown areas. I did a route called Nightmare a couple of years ago, about a year.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think was probably my best traditional climbing that I've ever done. I think it's the best route I've ever done, because it brought everything together, all my skills, all the sport, all the trad, all the everything, all came together. But I felt like I maybe just pushed it out a little bit on that one. I got into a position where, having done it, I thought, you got just a little bit close to where you shouldn't have been in that route. And it was the top section. I got to a point where if I thought it was going to be as hard as what it turned out, I probably would have not gone for it, but it looked not that bad. And I think my ego got the better of me. It was like, oh, yeah. I felt as though I'd climbed the route. I looked back on what I'd done. I thought, I've done the meat of the route. I have to have done, because that was so hard that I must have done it. So the top section must be okay. And I looked up and it looked all right. There was some chalk on it. I thought, yeah, it's going to be fine. And I want this route. I want it. I've done all this hard work. You know, I've got to this point. And it wasn't. It was really hard. I had to totally keep it together. Like, I really had to keep it together. And it was an amazing experience. But I felt as though afterwards that, yeah, you know, I wasn't miles away from falling off. And if I had fallen off, it could have very easily been very bad. Mm-hmm. And it's not a position I'd like to have been in, to be honest. But
yeah,
we've got away with it.
Yeah. Try not to have too many of those.
Oh, no.
And do you, would you say that you're of the opinion that when you go and do something which feels, you know, like a little bit uncomfortable, and, you know, whether it's spicy or whether it's a little bit dangerous, is that it's a bit like a sort of a training adaptation effect, that if you give yourself lots of little chunks of that over time, it's like a dosage thing, and you become immune to it. So therefore, when people like think about the kind of the falling element, actually falling and sort of that confidence with it is actually sort of like a cumulative lifetime effect. So climber X, who's been doing it for 20 years, and also a climber Y, who's also been climbing for 20 years, if climber X has got 5,000 lead falls under their belt, they will just naturally be more comfortable than the one who still has climbed 20 years, but has only got 500 lead falls under their belt.
So in answer to that, I would say absolutely, no doubt about that. And I've got first-hand experience of that as well, because I used to think that I was pretty good at falling off and very committed, and I would really go for it. Because, you know, when you're on an on-site, on sport, so we're talking sport here, you need to be able to go, you need to be committed when you're pushing your limits, because if you're scared, then obviously you've lost your edge completely. Anyway, I thought I was very good at going for it, but it was only after a couple of years of red pointing that I realized that I hadn't been very good at it, and I had got better and better and better. But I thought I was really good. You know, people would say to me, like, what's your assets? And I would say, oh, one of my best things is I can just totally go for it. You know, I'm not scared of falling. And man, I was scared of it. And I didn't go for it. I'd get to that move where you think, right, just one slap, and they'd be like, ooh, 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 I'm not too sure. Ooh. And I wouldn't go for it. So it took maybe 2 or 3 years of specifically red pointing, because that's the time when you fall and you're just in the air. There's no time to think about the falling. With on sighting, you get to a position where you think, oh, that looks like a hard move. That's a long way. What's that hold like? Is it any good? Oh, I'm not sure about that. Whereas with red pointing, you know what the hold is, and you know you just go for it. You know you can do the move. You've done it before. So you go for it, and either you get it or suddenly you're off. And then you're in the air, you're on the rope, and it was fine. Yeah. So you get used to that complete commitment, because when you're on the hardest of routes, you're only going to get it like, I don't know, 1 in every 10 times, but you have to give 100%, has to be 100%, 99, you won't do it. So 100% commitment, and you get very used to giving it 100%. And that translates back into on-sighting and then back into traditional climbing as well. And I guess onto bouldering and all sorts of things, it comes back down. So for me, it was the red pointing where I learned a lot. And then going back to your original question, it was time of doing that. I don't think you can do it like 2 or 3 times a year and expect to be any good at it. And I guess there will be a skill element in how you actually fall as well. Just that, you know, they say cats always land on their feet. They're good at falling. I guess humans, when they fall off on a rope, they know what to do. I mean, I can remember falling off on a long route ages ago with loads of slack, having the rope around the back of my leg and having the time, you know, completely going for the move and not getting it. And as I came off, I grabbed the rope and like untangled my legs from it. And, perfectly. And it was totally okay. It was all part of the deal. You know, it wasn't an issue. It was just what you did. It was part of the route. The fall was part of the route.
Yeah, I think the red pointing thing is actually a really underrated kind of comment or strategy that you talked about. I've seen you write about it and talk about it in the past. Mm. And I've always like, oh, I don't know about that. I just can't quite see it. But then over a couple of years ago, when I got involved with a hard red point on a trad route, which I found quite sort of scary in terms of the sort of the spacing of the gear and the kind of exposure on it. And I had to go through that full red pointing process into it, to the point where I was just going to 100% with a really long fall onto a single piece that I was like kind of quite worried about. And I really, really didn't want that one to rip. Was that I found after a while, I was like, I'm okay with this. And this is just fine. And it really, really helped my climbing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that goes back again to that sort of like rationalizing it and being able to say, you know, this is going to be totally fine. And the more you can tell yourself that it is going to be totally fine and be completely committed, then I think that is when you start to really climb. That's when you find that you're properly climbing, because when you're scared, you're not moving properly. You know, you're more concerned about hurting yourself, or you it's in your mind, it's playing with your mind. And only when you can be completely free of fear are you really properly climbing. And I think that's quite an experience, which I do worry that many rock climbers don't ever get. Yeah. You know, there must be huge numbers of climbers that go out to Stanage, and for them leading is what it's all about, and they just brick it the whole way up. You know, they don't have that complete flow where it's just go, and if they never experience that, that's kind of a shame, really.
I know, because it's some of the best bits of climbing.
It's the best bit.
Yeah,
it's what I climb for. Like that complete flow and that total absorption in the movement is everything for me. That is the most important part of climbing.
Yeah. Right. Let me round out with one last question, Steve, because I've already taken up a good chunk of your evening and everything of that. So I want you to still be able to enjoy the rest of your evening. So let me ask you a little bit about a topic which I think has again, a lot of relevance to others, and I'm sure you'll have an opinion and view on this, because we often see climbers like do their strength work and try and get stronger, more powerful, whatever it might be, through either training or climbing on rock outside. But I think climbers can have a tendency to think that strength is just about the forearm, the fingers, perhaps a little bit of the shoulders. But I think there's a much more interesting conversation to be had around applying strength all the way through your body. As in, we've got our hands on the rock, we've also got our feet on the rock, and how we actually apply, you know, this incredible dead hanging strength that everyone has nowadays because they spent so much time on fingerboards, but actually getting it and applying it on rock, because a fingerboard does not directly transfer to the rock. It just doesn't, because it's not the same thing exactly.
No, I mean, it's interesting. We had this discussion with someone the other day. We were trying the green traverse, and the guy said, how come I can't do the green traverse when I've been fingerboarding for the last like year? Because the green traverse is just like a rail. It's just like a rail on a fingerboard, and he couldn't do it. So there's obviously much more to it. One of the things that I think is really important about training for climbing, something that really helped me, was to actually think about what you need to train for your targets and your goals. Have a really sort of in-depth look at it. You know, what does your goal demand of you? Does it demand huge amounts of ring work? Does it demand lots of deadlifts? Does it demand this? Does it demand that? Have a real think about it, because it probably doesn't, to be honest. And I think one of the problems these days people have is they tend to be sort of like sucked into training exercises which may feel more mentally comfortable to do. You know, it's quite easy mentally to go and do a load of gym work type stuff. It feels rewarding. You can see some gains. It's easy to fit into a sort of time frame. But does that really help with what you want to do? Not sure. So I spent some time working out what I needed to get me up my various targets over the years. And like you were saying before, it's a whole body thing, isn't it? You know, you need legs, you need arms, you need back, you need shoulders. So work out what exercises are going to actually help with that. And a lot of those exercises, like the core work, the leg work, that kind of stuff, you can fit them in as a sort of a break between maybe you say you're doing some fingerboarding. You can only do that 6 seconds every minute or two, can't you? So it leaves you a lot of dead time where you can be doing something else, and that something else is really useful. One of the things that I've really noticed with a lot of people that I've coached over the years is, and this is we've had this conversation before, this is a real standout point, is people's ability to lift their leg is often shockingly poor. Like, you look at it and think, how can you get up anything? Like, how can you even get up the stairs? Like, their feet literally will not go up. So, and it's very easy to point out what the problem is to them then. It's you're saying, look, you can't lift your leg up more than whatever, like a foot high. How are you supposed to get your foot onto that foothold? And a lot of time it's, you know, hip strength and hip flexibility, which can be quite often trained quite significantly. And that is something people just be like, oh my God, I never even thought about that. But when you show them it, it's really obvious. So I think being able to isolate different ideas can make a really big difference. I don't know what your views are on all that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of broadly agree in the sense that I think there's a lot of additional work that you can do aside from, you know, like your dead hanging sessions. I think I definitely see a pattern in route climbers that they don't apply the intensity element enough on the wall in a bouldering sense, because when they go and try their projects or on sites, that feels like an intense experience. and they forget that there's two types of intensity in a way. There's like an intensity, strength, endurance, power endurance thing, and fatigue and going through that, and some mental intensity. But there's also an intensity element of applying the whole chain of strength in a climbing setting for just two moves, three moves, six moves, but something, you know, pretty short and intense. And if you don't do that regularly as a route climber, you basically detune from that and you forget how to coordinate and properly apply intensity on the rock or on the wall. And I think that's one really important part that people forget. And then...
Yeah. So yeah, that's, I guess that goes, what I was just saying there about have a good look at your target and see what it really demands of you. Because in most cases, hard routes do demand a very short, well, not very, but pretty short, it very intense set of moves. And some, you can look at most of them and go, actually, yeah, well, do you know what? That takes 15 seconds. Mm. You know, that crux is 15 seconds. And you say, oh, okay, so I bimble up the start to that knee bar rest, and then I got a few hard moves, and then I got 15 seconds, and then it's all over. And you go, oh, yeah, it's a 30-meter route, which takes 20 minutes. But actually, it's 15 seconds, which I need to be able to totally nail it for. And it's then that you realize where you need to be training. So I completely agree. I think route climbers, especially as they get older, they fall into this sort of total stamina plod, and they just fall off on the hard moves. You know, they either totally go down the stamina routes and hunt them out, those routes have got no hard moves, or they just get spat off on the crux every single time. The intensity, I think, is really, really important, really important.
Yeah, and I'll quite often work with older climbers and say, right, what are you aiming for? You know, why do you actually want to work with me? And they're like, I want to climb my hardest ever. And I'll say, well, what are the primary reasons why you think you're not climbing this grade or this project? Oh, it's too hard for me at the moment in terms of the difficulty element, really hard bouldery sequence. And then I'll say, so tell me a little bit about your general bouldering habits and how much you do. Oh, I've not done that for a few years now. All right, okay. Let's just, I mean, we don't even have to get particularly sciencey or, you know, really clever about the training here. It's just pulling back some basic elements back into your habits of, if you want to climb at your limit and push your limit, you have to put in some really quality intensity into your weekly, you know, content. It's just desperate if you don't. You've got to be like a total superstar or projecting, you know, beast that can just have the best strategy ever if you want to get around that.
Yeah. I think for people that are operating in their sort of like 50s, for instance, and then want to climb hard sport routes, they need to ensure that they're doing some element of not necessarily full on two move bouldering, not necessarily that, it's useful, but doing some 10 move, very hard boulder problems, at least a good bunch of that, probably every week, to be honest, or a good block of that anyway. And don't just go into just route climbing, because it won't work. At the end of the day, most hard sport routes are like the 200 meters or the 400 meters, and they're not the kilometer run.
Yeah,
not at all. Bouldering is like the 50 meter run or the 100 meters, but you need to be good at the 400 meters. But as soon as you become just good at the mile, you've blown it.
Yeah. I could probably chat for a very long time here.
I reckon.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure, Steve, and chatting again. And it's been too long. We haven't kind of seen each other or chatted all this kind of stuff anyway. I should come up to Malham again with you and we can have a massive long car journey.
Yeah, man, those car journeys are good. Yeah, we have this conversation like all the time.
Yeah.
That's one of the best things. But whether we'll be going to Malham this year, who knows? There's still things to do. Things to do, definitely. But yeah, come and join us, man. Come and join us. No cracks there, though.
I know. I'll plod up some 7As on some edges or something like that.
You'll be right, for sure. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Yeah, I hope everybody else isn't getting too bored by our waffle. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Yeah, no, it's all good. And where can people find you in terms of like websites, any social media links and things like that? Because I'm sure people watching and listening will want to, I mean, I'm sure most people will know exactly who you are, but for anyone that doesn't, where can they find you?
So if anybody wants to fire any questions my way, they could either go through my website, which is stevemcclure.com. steve-mcclure.com. You just type it into Google and you'll find
it. We'll put it in the links below this anyway.
Yeah. I'm always happy to reply to any questions. I quite like chatting away, and especially at the moment, I've got nothing better to do. Great. Nice one.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks so much, Steve.